Hi, welcome to Neuroverse, a podcast hosted by Carolina
and Clara, where we discuss all matters from neuroscience to philosophy and beyond. Welcome back to another episode of Neuroverse. Today, our topic is interoception. To begin, I'm going to start by defining interoception. So this is our ability to perceive our internal body states, and this includes the processes of sensing, interpreting, integrating, and regulating signals that come from within our bodies. And so often this is referred to as our sixth sense. And this is such an important aspect of being because it shapes our sense of self, and it is fundamental to how we experience the world and how we experience, in particular, our emotions, which also ultimately guides how we make decisions. And I think being a neuroscientist, it's really easy to ignore anything outside of the central nervous system or outside of the brain. So I only got introduced to this concept scientifically through the field of psychology. So I kind of wanted to do this episode on a bit about the psychology and neuroscience of interoception and just kind of highlight how important it is in shaping cognitive processes.
Yeah, it's a really cool topic. And like you said, as a neuroscientist, we're so trained to only look at the external stimuli and the responses to external stimuli, because it's impossible, pretty difficult and challenging to study interoception when using animal models, but also using the techniques that we use. So yeah, psychology has done a lot of work in this and some really cool research.
Mm-hmm. Exactly as you said, yeah, a lot more has been studied in neuroscience about how we perceive the external world. There's so much research on sensory perception, how we integrate visual, auditory, olfactory, tactile cues. But there are also signals that come from within, which includes biochemical signals. So for example, peptides that come from the food we eat. They can also be mechanical, so in terms of how we move, which makes up a lot of proprioception, which shapes how we sense the space around us and being in the space. And interoception relies on a bidirectional signaling between the brain and our internal organs. And besides sensing nutrients in our gut, as I mentioned, this is also largely sensing our own heart rates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was under the impression that interoception was more about sensing physical signals like heart rate and maybe temperature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, temperature was, yeah.
I wasn't aware about like the gut molecules and nutrients and everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I guess when you think about it, there's actually a whole multitude of signals that could come from within. We just rarely think about it.
Yeah.
But there's like so much happening in our bodies that are not necessarily directly related to our brain.
Yeah, that's true. Also, it now makes me realize things like hormones.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a woman, fluctuates so much like throughout the month, and then it's really difficult to detangle like what is me and what is the effect of the hormone.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and it's also hard to separate like the cause and effect and where these signals originate from.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I said, it's a bidirectional signaling, and so especially in terms of hormones, hormonal cycles and signaling pathways are so complex and usually multidirectional and like cyclical. And in terms of like temperature, you can also imagine how that could be regulated by so many different things, like your environment, but also like the inflammatory state of your body and also your brain. And just once you start thinking about it, you realize you can form a much more holistic perspective of brain and body.
Mm-hmm.
And how it shapes the mind.
Yeah,
which is actually funny, because when I was reading about this topic, I came across a lot of people hating on Descartes.
I was actually gonna bring him up later.
Yeah, because he's famous for his dualistic perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And separating the mind and the
body.
Yeah,
but he doesn't you know, separate them completely and throw them on opposite ends, you know, they still causally interact. So he came up with the theory of mind, mm-hmm. which suggests that humans can construct a model in their brains of thoughts and intentions of others, which is something I want to talk about later as well.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but basically I just wanted to mention, though, that the simplified idea of dualism, which isn't the whole of what Descartes said, but it can be quite dangerous in terms of, like, completely segregating brain and mind, you know, and encouraging the lack of taking into account what's happening in the body when looking at neuroscience.
Yeah.
So a really famous figure in the field of specifically emotional processing and interoception is Antonio Damasio.
Oh, yeah.
Who researches mainly the role of emotions in social cognition and decision-making. And he came up with a theory called the somatic marker hypothesis, which rests on two key ideas. So the first is that emotions play a key role in shaping our ability to make fast, rational decisions under uncertain situations. And the second key idea is that extracerebral changes, so changes in the body, which are termed somatic markers, largely underlie these emotions. And so it kind of overall goes against the idea that all of human reasoning and decision making is based on cognition or learning alone, but it instead puts an emphasis on how our bodily states can influence cognition.
Mm-hmm.
And he also says that these somatic markers, which are signals that influence how we process and respond to stimuli, can be conscious or non-conscious. And so an example of a non-conscious somatic marker may be our undeliberated inhibition of responding to loud sounds when there's a construction work going on and we know that it's not threatening, or craving or avoiding specific foods based on our previous experiences with them, like avoiding a food that has made us feel nauseous in the past. Things like this really can be described as fitting the somatic marker hypothesis. And this also just fits general peripheral theories of emotion, which propose that the basis of emotional feeling states is our representation and perception of changes in our bodily physiology.
Mm.
And there's been some really interesting work supporting this, showing that individuals who are more attuned to their own bodily responses experience emotions with heightened intensity.
No, yeah, that's really interesting.
And other studies have also shown that enhanced interoceptive accuracy can be linked to improved memory and decision making.
Hmm.
However, there's also major challenges in studying interoception, because they're mainly human studies that rely on subjective self-report measures. And the most commonly used way to measure interoception is with a task known as the heartbeat detection task.
Okay.
And so, as I mentioned, a major example of interoception representing the relationship between the brain and the body is our ability to detect the heart rate, or communication between the brain and the heart. And so this heartbeat detection task basically involves participants either counting their own heart rates in a set time and then comparing it to the actual heart rate, or counting their heart rates in relation to a external stimulus, like a clock. Yeah, so this is a really widely used paradigm, but as you can imagine, this still presents a major challenge of not knowing whether better interoceptive accuracy measured through this task is because of better interoceptive accuracy in terms of our cognitive interpretation of our heartbeat signals.
Is it a cognitive interpretation or just a physical, like, you just count it, right? You feel it and you count it?
Yeah, but that's a cognitive interpretation. As in,
okay.
So when you're doing the heartbeat detection task, it's meant to be a readout of interoceptive accuracy because it's your ability to perceive your heartbeat.
Okay. Yeah.
But our internal signals across people may actually be different.
Yeah.
So various factors may affect how easily you can detect your heartbeat, mm-hmm. including your weight, your general body structure, which is influenced by your age mm-hmm. and your gender, and it may also be affected by your mood, your attention in the moment.
And your state of mind, like if you're anxious or not.
Yeah. And your alertness. Mm. And also, anxiety is related to your heart rate. Yeah. So how fast your heart rate is. So it's actually really interesting. I was teaching this topic in a psychology seminar. Mm-hmm. And to begin, I got all of the students to do their heartbeat detection task. I mean, not the actual task.
Yeah.
But I told them to count their heartbeats for 1 minute. And I, of course, did it myself. And I was teaching like 3 back-to-back sessions. Mm-hmm. And so every time I did it. And the first session, I was so nervous because I was so nervous to teach that my heartbeat was so strong and it was very easy. Mm-hmm. By the last session, I could barely detect it, both because my heartbeat was much quieter, mm-hmm. but also because I was tired. And so I was less focused. And also, like, the students mentioned some really interesting things, like there was a clock in the room and it was ticking really loudly, and a lot of them found it really distracting, and so that would also affect how easily you can detect it. And some students, like, held their hearts, you know, or like touched their bodies or felt their pulse, and others put their hands on their desk, and this, like, it was probably controlled for. In most studies, they'd get the participants to, like, not touch their own bodies and to put their hands down. But yeah, this just overall demonstrated to me as well, like, how variable this could be across sessions, mm-hmm. and just how many factors would influence this, and how it's definitely not a perfect readout of interoception.
Yeah, and it's interesting how, because I wasn't sure if you're allowed to, like, touch your heart or feel your pulse, because I feel like, yeah, that will give you very different readouts of what your heart rate is. If you had to just sit there and try and, like, feel your heartbeat, it would be so difficult unless you were anxious and it was pumping.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's probably the major factor that influenced it. At least I can say that from firsthand experience.
Yeah.
But this links to something I also wanted to talk about, which is called alexithymia, which is an impaired ability to be aware of and identify and describe one's own feelings. So under the context of linking emotions to interoceptive ability, in alexithymia, there tends to be a decoupling of implicit and explicit emotional responses. So implicit emotional responses would be like physiological arousal, and then explicit emotional responses would be self-reported emotional intensity. Mm. And the alexithymia can be viewed as a dimension ranging from low to high in the general population. And it can also be clinically pathological. And it's also related to many neurological disorders, particularly several neurodevelopmental disorders, one example being autism. And overall, people suggest that it's a relatively stable psychological trait because it doesn't tend to change a lot over the lifespan. However, it can improve over the course of an intervention for depression, for example. And interestingly, these changes in alexithymia scores also often correlate with the efficacy of drug treatment for depression. Mm. And so this link between alexithymia and these neurological disorders do suggest that there is a biological basis, and there is probably a genetic component that could contribute to this. However, psychoanalytical theorists have also emphasized the contribution of some early developmental deficiencies to alexithymia, like childhood trauma or negative primary caregiver interactions. And so it seems to be, as many other things, a mix between nature and nurture, so to speak. Interestingly, clinically relevant alexithymia affects around 10% of the population, which is a number that is a lot higher than I would expect. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I wanted to also bring up this topic is because there was a really interesting study by Murphy et al. In 2018, and they tested the correlation between interoceptive accuracy based on this heartbeat detection task and alexithymia scores in a group of participants that were not a clinical population. And they showed that there was a strong negative relationship between alexithymia and performance on this task. So that means there was higher alexithymia scores when the interoceptive accuracy was poorer, as you would expect. However, this was only the case when various control variables were included in the data, such as blood pressure, heart rate variability, age, anxiety, and depression. And so, as we've discussed, these factors really do influence not only performance on the task, as you'd expect, but the relationship between performance on the task and alexithymia scores. And so this really highlights how these various factors do need to be controlled for in studies, and it may also describe some of the variability that has been described in studies looking at interoception, because there has been huge variability in the results.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So when I've never heard of alexithymia before.
Me neither.
Yeah. And when researching it, it had several different similar definitions, but one of them, which I found interesting, was emotional blindness. And related to this study, and the results found that with alexithymia, you may not perceive non-effective interoceptive signals, such as the heart rate, as well as those that don't. It leads me to ask, does this mean that some people like don't experience anxiety, or do they experience it but they're not aware of it because they can't detect their heart rate?
Yeah, that's exactly the perplexing thing about this, is it's hard to know whether it's just a deficit in perception or a deficit in like physiological signals.
Yeah, or it could be similar to like children that, you know, they feel, you know, hunger or fear or pain, but they don't know how to express it, so they just cry. And maybe people with alexithymia, even though they can't identify what is the cause of their feeling, but they still feel it, but they just can't associate the words to the emotion or identify what is the cause.
But you know, it may also be an inability to
like keep track,
attribute
of
salience to these emotions or these signals, because like this just reminded me of the link between alexithymia and childhood trauma, for example. It could be like a learned way to kind of ignore a lot of your internal stimuli.
And it's interesting looking at studies that try to compare like emotional processing and non-effective interoceptive signals. So like, so emotions versus things like arousal and heart rate and hunger. And it leads me to think, so could it be that those who are really tuned into their non-effective internal states, such as hunger, like some people can just skip lunch and they're fine, versus those that, no, they absolutely need to have lunch at noon, sharp. Do you think that they're more sensitive and more, and to their emotional states and have a greater saliency? Or do you think that maybe the correlation is not this clear?
And that's where you add an extra layer of cognition, because this is, again, it's just me speaking from personal experience. Like, I am quite good at changing my needs based on what I want them to be. So in terms of hunger, I'm pretty good at hunger suppression if I just really, really want to suppress it in the short term. Then, so like, if I went a whole day without food, for example, I would definitely rebound in like the next day, but I would be able to do it, you know? And so in terms of what you said, it made me think of like, there's an extra level of motivation of like how much you want to, it's again like choosing to ignore signals. I mean, it's how conscious or unconscious this choice is, because a lot of these studies, they address the more unconscious side of things about how we naturally, or they want to at least address how we naturally perceive these signals, but there can still be motivation, especially with something like hunger, based on like the availability of resources around you. Like if there's not food available, you can easily not feel hungry in the short term.
I think I have a slightly different experience in the sense that I need to eat regularly, because if I don't, like, I have headaches, I crash, like, I need to drink water regularly as well. I really, really suck at suppressing all of these physiological states. However, if I'm like doing surgery and I need to be super focused and my adrenaline levels are high, I can deal with it and I can hold on for a bit longer, but not that much longer.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like you have a greater capacity for that than I do.
Yeah, I have to do the opposite and remind myself to eat and drink and not ignore my interoceptive signals.
Yeah.
And so to a certain extent, it is also something that can be learned, right? Mm-hmm. And also that's where you can bring in like mindfulness practices, like yoga, and how that can shape your interoceptive ability.
Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to say that alexithymia is also linked to deficits in empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a theory called simulation theory that people simulate feelings that they observe in others in order to predict and understand those feelings in people. And so it would make sense that an inability to accurately interpret your own internal affective state will lead to a difficulty in empathizing with others' feelings as well.
So also alexithymia brings up this idea of theory of mind, which suggests, as I mentioned previously, that humans can construct a model in their brains of the thoughts and intentions of others.
Mm-hmm.
So the theory states that children use their own emotions to predict what others do, and therefore we project our own mental states onto others. But this also ties in with mentalization, which is the ability to think about states of mind, so thinking about thinking. And this is also related to theory of mind. It's basically the psychoanalytical interpretation of theory of mind. And Heinz Wimmer and Joseph Perner were the first to investigate when children can understand false belief. And they did this by doing this experiment where children were presented with a scenario involving two characters, Sally and Anne. Sally puts a marble in a basket and leaves the room. And while she's gone, Anne moves the marble from the basket to a box. And then the children were then asked where Sally will look for the marble first when she returns. And being able to correctly answer that she will look in the basket, which is the original place the marble was in, indicates an understanding that others can hold beliefs about the world that are different from one's own, and that these beliefs can be false. So this ability to understand that people have their own beliefs, desires, and intentions, which can be different from reality, is a really crucial aspect of theory of mind. And so yeah, this was like a really cool psychoanalytical study carried out.
Yeah, and I have heard of it. It's commonly used still to study theory of mind, and this is particularly related to research into autism, actually. Mm-hmm. And theory of mind has been shown to have deficits in autism. I think it's a good example of how our internal systems affects how we perceive others in a social way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That actually led me to mirror neurons, and how mirror neurons are a class of neurons where they fire when an individual executes a motor act when he observes another individual performing that same act.
Mm-hmm.
And it's associated with intention understanding. So when observing an individual carry out an action, it questions what that action is being done and why. And so the intentionality of it is really interesting, and that I think those with alexithymia are probably lacking a lot, because given they don't have their own internal readout, they can't even begin to then be able to mirror that in anyone else.
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also interesting that the observation of the facial expression of disgust is activated by the same section of anterior insula, just like those with alexithymia, so in relating to the mirror system, and the areas that it affects correspond to the areas that are also affected by alexithymia.
Yeah. So I wanted to mention some of the brain regions that are associated with processing interoceptive information. And one region that came up the most is actually the anterior insular cortex, as you mentioned. And this insular cortex has been related to our perception of self the most, and several studies have naturally also linked it to interoception, since, as I mentioned right at the start, interoception shapes our sense of self. And one of the most interesting studies I came across was by Babbo Ribello in 2016, who measured heartbeat evoked neural responses with intracranial EEG. So that's where you often do this in epilepsy patients who are undergoing surgery. And so you get access into the brain and you can implant electrodes kind of deeper into the brain than just a normal scalp EEG recording, which is just on top of the scalp. And so they recorded intracranial EEG during also an ECG that records heart activity. And they related these to come out with heartbeat evoked neural responses. A heartbeat evoked response is a neural response recorded that is time locked to a specific phase in the heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, participants were told to let their minds wander freely during the recordings, but they are awake and conscious. And they had to rate their thoughts on an I or a me scale. So this was testing how much their thoughts related to themselves. For example, like if you were thinking, oh, I need to go shopping, or if you're thinking, I'm really uncomfortable right now, mm-hmm. that would be high on the I scale. But if you were thinking like, oh, her shoes aren't really nice, that would rate low on the scale. So they did have very few participants just because of the nature of the type of research, mm-hmm. but they found a significant correlation between these heartbeat evoked responses and I ratings in specific brain regions. And these were the right anterior insula, as well as the posteromedial cortex and the cingulate sulcus, which are all part of a famous network known to be involved in self-perception called the default mode network.
Mm.
And the default mode network is known to be highly active during normal mind wandering. So when the thoughts were rated highly on the I or the me scale, so they had to do with the self, there were larger amplitudes of heartbeat evoked responses in these regions that are part of the default mode network and the insular cortex. So there was a higher link between the bodily state
mm-hmm.
and the brain state. And overall, the study demonstrated that there is a link between visceral state monitoring and neural activity in regions associated with representation of self. And it really strengthens this link between self-perception and bodily state, which I find very interesting.
So when the heartbeat was high, the default mode network activity was also high?
No. So when the neural response that is time-locked to the heartbeat is larger in these brain regions that are part of the default mode network and the insular cortex, there were more thoughts related to I or me.
Okay. No, yeah, it's really cool that it's time-locked to the heart rate. I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of bodily functions and interoceptive awareness, as just general awareness and of how you feel. Yeah.
It reminds me of an episode we did ages ago on breathing and how there was a study that showed a link between like phases in breathing mm-hmm. and phases in neural activity, I think it was.
Yeah.
During sleep. And so it's just crazy to think that this whole time we think, you know, we have like a certain amount of control on our thoughts and our neural state. But as Antonio Damasio's theory highlights, a lot of what is happening in our brains are just a result of what is happening in our body.
Yeah.
And in terms of the breath and the heart rate and things that are very much less conscious.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problem is that we also exert bidirectional influence. Mm-hmm. So the brain, the cognitive state then reshapes our bodily state. And so that's where it's hard to draw the line between what's conscious and unconscious or autonomic or mm-hmm. non-autonomic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also can't help but think that, you know, so much of it is just related to us having some sort of internal clock, you know, like the timing of the breathing, the timing of the heart rate, the timing of the neural activity, and how they're all so interlocked. And what we were talking about earlier in terms of being able, like with alexithymia, being able to, whether or not you have a readout of your emotional state or interoceptive state or heart rate, and it just all seems to be so timed. I don't know.
Yeah. Like following rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And ultimately, all of the signaling is also cyclical, in that like something will affect something, will affect something, will affect something, and then it all comes back.
Yeah.
So it only makes sense that it would be kind of rhythmic in nature anyways,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there have been several other studies relating interoceptive ability to specific brain region activity. And so, for example, the accuracy of heartbeat perception, again,
mm-hmm.
as a readout of interoception, has been found to be associated with the volume of gray matter in the right anterior insular cortex, yet again implicating this brain region. And then the same regions have been implicated to have abnormal neural responses in alexithymia. So in particular, in relation to difficulties describing feelings or difficulties identifying feelings, which are two major features in the questionnaire that is used to measure alexithymia. So these difficulties in identifying and describing feelings were found to be negatively correlated with neural responses in the amygdala in response to sad faces, and also negatively correlated with neural responses in the fusiform face area parahippocampal gyrus and superior temporal gyrus in response to surprised faces. And other studies have also found hypoactivation of the amygdala in response to disgusting or fear-inducing pictures, and that this correlates with difficulties in identifying feelings. And so overall, it seems like there is less activity in the amygdala, which is the brain region most highly linked to emotional processing in alexithymia, and in particular when processing emotions with negative valence like fear and disgust.
Yeah. You know what's also interesting about these studies is that when it's self-reported about not being good at emotional recognition, isn't that in great part what other people tell you? Like, you as a person, you don't really have I think that you're normal and that you have a normal level of emotional awareness and perception. It's your external environment and the people around you that are like the basis point that you can compare yourself to, in that, oh, I'm more sensitive than most people, or oh, I'm less sensitive than most people. So it's kind of ironic in that you, with alexithymia, you lack this ability to recognize emotional states and recognize perhaps intentions in others, but it's that then allows you to recognize in yourself that maybe you don't have a good recognition of emotional states.
Yeah. I definitely agree. And also, it depends, because on the kind of the extreme ends, I guess you would be able to recognize when you're not great at... No, wait, you're right. Because we're social human beings, like, most of our ability to recognize how well we are at interpreting emotions may be actually how good we are at interpreting other people's emotions,
mm-hmm.
as well.
Exactly.
Beyond just, like, what other people tell you.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely. I think there's a certain truth to self-report questionnaires, but it's not
yeah.
a perfect readout whatsoever. And it may be able to, like, differentiate kind of the extreme ends of the spectrum, but not so much the kind of middle ground.
Yeah.
Anyways, on that note, on the inevitable flaws of research,
mm-hmm.
We'll end today's episode, and I really hope you enjoyed it, and go count your heartbeat.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Feel free to share it with your friends and family through our social media, neuroverse_pod, and check out our website, neuroversepod.com, for resources and our blog on today's topic.
Thank you for listening.